From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Usually on Good Food, I'm the one asking the questions. So when Frances Lam, host of The Splendid Table, asked me to sit down for an interview, I have to admit, I was nervous. But we had such a good time and such a great conversation that I thought it was worth sharing. So here we go. We're re-airing this episode of The Splendid Table with their permission. If there's something you've wanted to know about my life or my career, it's probably in here.
You know, so the exact birthday of our show is actually kind of lost to history. As our producer and co-creator Sally puts it, you know, we never bothered to write it down because we were never sure it was going to last anyway. But it was certainly sometime in the mid or late 90s. It was an unusual little program on Minnesota Public Radio talking about food and hosted by our dear Lynn Rosetto Casper, an expert in Italian cuisine with a curiosity that spanned the entire universe. Well, right around the same time, there was another show. Another unusual little program on Southern California Public Radio, talking about food and hosted by an expert on Italian cuisine who had a curiosity that spans the entire universe. That show is Good Food from KCRW, and that host is Evan Kleiman. Far from, you know, a rival or competitor, Evan is one of my heroes. I've always loved listening to her ask revealing questions from everyone, from like massively famous chefs to local heroes to like obscure but fascinating researchers. And Evan's always bringing out stories from other people, and she doesn't really talk about herself that much. I listened to her for years before ever realizing that she had one of the most influential Italian restaurants in Los Angeles in the 80s, and, you know, therefore, one of the most influential Italian restaurants in the country, really. It was called Angeli Cafe, and Marcella Hazan once called it one of the most authentic Italian restaurants in America. And, you know, so we wanted to spend some time with Evan to see where her life and food comes from, where it's taken her, and all her listeners over the years. Evan Kleiman, it is so great to have you on the show.
I am like beyond honored and excited to get to talk to you, Frances.
My God. No way. Come on. This is so great. This is there's so much we can talk about having shows on opposite sides of the country or and all that and covering so much of the same time period. But I actually want to start by kind of going way back with you. I once heard you tell this story about when you were traveling in Italy for the first time as a teenager, and I think this probably was in the late 60s or maybe early 70s. And you talked about how you overheard men on the train talking about the meal they just had, and that you realized in that moment that you'd never actually heard an adult man talk about food before. So I think that's striking for a lot of reasons, but what I started thinking about was, what was it about you that keyed into that fact? Or like, how did you even notice that?
Okay, so when that happened, it was 1970. I was 17 years old.
Okay.
I had graduated really early from high school, and so I took a break. I had been working all through, I mean, starting in junior high, so I had money saved, and I went to Europe. And I had a Ural pass, a first-class Ural pass that my mom gave me as a gift for my trip.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, I was in this compartment with these men who were in northern Italy, so they were very, you know, beautiful suits, briefcases, and me. And because of my French, I guess, I could understand enough of what they were saying to get it. And why I was teed up to key into that was because I was just a total besotted food nerd, always. it was kind of the way, my way in to understand the world and people, who sometimes made me feel really uncomfortable. So, food was something that I just loved to make, obviously, and eat, but also read about. And I mean, this was like, I would say starting to read about food happened when I was like 9 or 10, maybe.
Wow.
And there was no internet. So it was like cookbooks that were interesting, headnotes, introductions to cookbooks. I was just a voracious compiler of weird food stuff.
Well, certainly in the 50s and 60s, I think for a young person, even a child, as you said, you're 9 years old, like that was probably pretty unusual in even in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. I was considered to be a weirdo. Like, I would ask my mom's friends if they had any old gourmet magazines they would give me. And I remember one year around Passover, I found this recipe for matzo balls that had chopped parsley and nutmeg in them. And so I convinced my mother she should let me make matzo balls that year. And she accused me of being a heretic.
You're kidding me.
Because it was...
You're excommunicated?
Because they were just so, you know, out of the mainstream. It's so funny, you know, to think back to that time. But yeah.
Well... Okay, but then how did you get to Italy? You mentioned you'd spoken French, and you know, you I understand that you went to Europe after high school. But how did you get to Italy in particular?
I was going to France. I had been a French major in high school, and and I went to France, and it pretty much just immediately spit me out.
Oh, no.
Well, I was super shy. I was a super shy kid. I was by myself. And they just, like shopkeepers, people that you would interact with, you know, walking around as a stranger, as a tourist, they weren't patient with my imperfect French. And so I just started... You know, it was the period of time, the beginning, I think, the beginnings of more kids on the road backpacking. And,
okay, interesting.
And you would meet, you know, kids in hostels you stayed at. And so that kind of precipitated just getting on the road and traveling to different places. And when I ended up in Italy, which I went to a few times because... I ended up going to all through Yugoslavia and which was Yugoslavia and Greece. Mm-hmm. I lived in Greece for a while and then ended up coming back. Wow. So coming back to Italy, and it was weird. It felt like a place that I belonged. I don't know how that happens.
That's so fascinating. And I know, you know, the idea of a life-changing experience is obviously a cliche, but I certainly think that probably was exactly that for you, as we'll talk about. But what were some of your strongest food memories there? Do you remember what the men on the train ate? Or what did you eat when you were there?
They weren't eating. They were just discussing what they had for lunch and what they were hoping to have for dinner, at which I just thought was absolutely fascinating because... I just wasn't around any men in Los Angeles who had anything to do with food preparation at all, unless they were incinerating chicken on the barbecue.
It was more the incineration, the act of incineration.
Exactly.
That was exciting, not the chicken.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the fire, you know, and the tongs in one hand and the beer in the other. Every part of that Italian experience was just so engaging for me. Like, it was the time when trains, you could roll down the windows completely, the windows from the side corridors after you were out of your compartment. And so when you would pull into a station, there would be vendors there with baskets, like actual baskets made of natural materials, selling sandwiches. So even getting like a rosetta, you know, these northern Italian hard roles that are almost completely empty on the inside, filled with maybe two slices of the thinnest mortadella ever, was like a peak experience.
And during that time, you actually stayed with families, right? And you'd said that you, that's kind of where your apprenticeship in cooking Italian food began, because you would stay and you would make dinner with the families when you'd prepare food.
Right.
What are some moments you remember doing that?
Well, the thing, so I was, you know, an only child of a single parent in LA. I didn't grow up with any grandparents around me. I think when I went to Italy, it's like I found these families, even if they lasted briefly. So it was, you know, in the day where you would stay in a bed and breakfast, not an Airbnb.
Yeah.
And this is post-war Italy, still before Italy really became an industrialized nation. So things were transitioning from, you know, the grinding poverty of the post-war years. And they were still pretty difficult. I mean, like if you wanted to take a shower, you had to make an appointment and pay extra. So they would turn on the tiny little hot water heater that was immediately above the shower. And you would just be there with this family, sometimes sleeping in the same bedroom as one of the family members. And I was so constantly fearful, even though I was on this, you know, trip, that I would spend a lot of time with the family, and I would just help the mom or the grandmother, whoever was cooking, and as a way to feel comfortable and centered, because cooking always made me feel that way.
Well, sorry, when you said fearful, you mean just fearful of like going out and exploring, but you would feel safe in these homes.
Exactly. My shyness was really considerable. I had to like force myself to do everything. And I think what I loved about those years was how I understood that things that were unbelievably simple could be so completely delicious. And that even in a city, everybody seemed to have links to wherever these things were made. And
which,
you know, growing up in Los Angeles, even when I did, I mean, you knew about orange trees, but but it wasn't like you felt that the farm was really close to you in any major way.
Yeah. And as wonderful as Southern California citrus is, oranges the diet do not make.
No. You know, you could go to Knott's Berry Farm, and at that time, there actually were farms there and berry farms. But it was, you know, it wasn't the same thing as integrated, where, you know, every family had olive oil from a cousin or an aunt or a sibling. And there weren't supermarkets yet.
Wow.
So all of the markets that were out on the streets were just real markets. And now, you know, it isn't that way so much. There are a few, but a lot of the markets you see, it's middlemen, and it's not necessarily the greatest produce ever. And
it became industrial.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember, though, if you were spending this much time cooking? And obviously, like you said, you were 17 at this time, and you weren't necessarily thinking, wow, one day I'm going to have my own restaurant, I'm going to be a chef. You were just spending time, I think. But are there things you learned to make at that time that you still make and eat today?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like keka, spaghetti alla keka, chopped tomatoes with fresh basil, set to marinate with olive oil and salt. And then right before the pasta's ready, you cut up some mozzarella and throw that in. And then toss that, which is room temperature, over pasta. I mean,
wait a minute. And the tomatoes are raw?
Yeah.
This is my signature dish that I invented. What are you talking about? you mean people ate
every housewife, every housewife made that. And I was just like, this is like the greatest thing
oh
I've
my
ever
God,
tasted.
I'm stunned. Oh my God, that has been like my like go-to move in August. I don't honestly think I invented that. I'm pretty sure I read it in the Dean and DeLuca cookbook, but I love it. That's the thing that that's the first thing that came in your mind because it's actually really good. So folks at home, if you've never made tomato sauce without actually making tomato sauce, you should really try it because it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And then, you know, you see all the variations. Somebody will put olives in it. Somebody will put anchovies in it. And you just understand the expansiveness of something that's simple.
That's Evan Kleiman, chef, author, and host of Good Food from KCRW.
Coming up, Frances Lam and I continue our conversation. Welcome back to Good Food. This week, I'm being interviewed by Frances Lam of The Splendid Table about the highs and occasional lows of my culinary career. I ended up majoring in Italian literature and film at UCLA, and during the whole period of my college years, I would scam on, not a scam, but I was like on top of getting like these weird grants from different organizations who would pay for me to go there and do some project. And I would like spend the whole summer there. And that's when I really started to see, watch women make like ravioli stuffed with potato and Parmesan, and then make just an amazing ragu, and then save the meat for, you know, the second course, and then sauce the potato ravioli with the quote gravy, the tomato gravy from braising the meat. And I just thought like, oh my, and that was from the portiere, which is, you know, the usually woman who would watch the door of apartment buildings, and she would collect all the mail and yell at everybody who was going in and out. and the building where a girlfriend of mine was living in Milan, she made this, and I was just like, oh my God, can I come to your house and watch you do it and help you? And people were so kind of taken aback that I would ask that they almost never said no.
You know, it's funny. It's I remember interviewing Claudia Rodin, you know, the iconic chronicler of Middle Eastern food. And she said a similar thing. You know, she would travel and she would ask people to teach her how to cook something. And they almost didn't. They were so stunned that someone would even ask that they didn't even. It didn't occur to them to say no, even though they thought it was weird. They were like, I guess, sure, come over here.
I mean, this is a period of time. It's so weird to have to say this. But until quite recently, food was really just something that you made so you could feed your family and you could eat. Mm-hmm. There wasn't this external societal focus on it from a performative standpoint, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Exactly. It was almost like if someone asked you, like, I love how you tie your shoes. Can you show me how to tie your shoes?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it just like it wasn't something that people honed in on as a subject of conversation and discovery and cultural intrigue and cultural cachet. And so, yeah, maybe there was a little bit of I don't even know what to do with this request. I guess I'll say yes. Or maybe it was just kind of charming. That someone would even care to ask?
Yeah,
or
I think that's and also the fact that I was so young.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably was pretty charming and flattering. And you know, I have to say that it wasn't just Italy. I mean, in those early years, in my teen years when I was traveling, you know, those months in Greece, where obviously I didn't speak Greek, and so you would just walk into a kitchen and look at what they had and point to things, and that's when I learned how to make those amazing Greek green beans, which are like almost as much olive oil as beans. And they're braised forever with onions and a little bit of tomato. And And it's the first time I learned that a type of ammonia was used as a leavening agent, because I went into a village bakery one day and saw something right out of the oven. And I said, I want one of those. And he says, you can't have one yet. And I didn't understand why. And then he let me smell it. And it was like somebody breaking a thing to keep me from fainting under my nose.
Oh, wow. I love that. So I love that you describe yourself as shy, and yet, you know, it takes a real courage to approach these people and have these conversations and ask them to show you their food. But let's fast forward a bit. So now you're back in Los Angeles. You know, you're traveling, you know, for summers and stuff like that, back to Italy or back to Europe. But you're working in film, but you found your way into cooking. And eventually, when you're, I guess, 30 or 31 years old, you open the first of your three restaurants, Angeli Cafe. What was it like?
Well, I had been cooking for money by then for like close to 15 years, because I was always expected to kind of support myself from as soon as I could. And so I started catering when I was like 15 or 16. And then I, in fact, worked for a Hollywood caterer. Oh, gosh. Starting with when I was in high school and all throughout college. And so it was very strange, because I was so programmed to go to college, get a degree, get a job that had somehow related somewhat to my degree. But my degree was in Italian literature and film. But, you know, I did get a job working for an independent producer, working with writers and being a reader. But I was still catering. You know, at night I would come home from work and I would still cook on my tiny little apartment-sized stove. And I realized at some point that I just really loved cooking more than anything, but I needed to get a job in a restaurant. So at that period of time, there was a restaurant in LA called Mangia. I would say it was the first real Italian restaurant that had, it was Tuscan. So it showed a completely different way of eating Italian food than most of what you saw at that time. And so I went in and I told her I knew how to make the food, and I offered to work for her for a couple of weeks for free. And then she could hire me, which is what happened. And I worked there for maybe a year or so. And then I was the opening chef of another restaurant that opened in LA. And then I opened my own place, 31, which I also, still shy, had to ask every single person I ever met for money to, you know, to raise money to open the place.
How would you describe that restaurant?
Oh, gosh, Angeli. I hope I don't start crying. It was probably the first casual cafe slash trattoria in LA in an environment where the decoration wasn't red booths and red and white check tablecloths. I was very good friends with an architect named Tom Main, because he had been going out with one of my roommates at UCLA. And so Tom was part of a seminal deconstructivist architecture firm of the 80s called Morphosis. He has gone on to win a Pritzker Prize and is immensely famous. And so I asked him if he would design my 1,000 square feet tiny little place on Melrose. And he did. It was, so at first it was like, I mean, it was very weird. We opened and people were standing in line for 2 hours to eat sandwiches and antipasti, because we didn't even make pasta at the beginning. I knew that I wanted to bring the menu in gradually so I wasn't overwhelmed. And so it was like this weird little hipster cafe.
Back before there were hipster cafes, back before there were...
Yeah, well, it was, you know, the boom, the young boomers who are, you know, reviled now that we're older and have ruined the world. But then, you know, we were this weird bulge in the demographics that traveled young. It was the 80s, so it was like boom economic years. So people had money. They weren't we weren't marrying super early. So often there would be a two-income living together household, and people went out. I mean, it was like, I think the first era of dining out being more than a something that you did for an occasion for most people.
It was where dining out became like a young form of entertainment.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this was, okay, so this is...
1984.
You opened this quirky, personal Italian cafe, very casual, but, you know, serving the food that you truly learned to cook while traveling in Italy.
Yep.
And... I know more than one person that credits you with inventing the caprese salad.
I just think that's ridiculous. I just think that's nuts. I don't believe that. I think that what I did was come up with a menu that to me was just basically copying menus. You know, menu after menu after menu that I experienced in very humble places where I ate in Italy in the 70s, and that kind of menu became like a template for the deluge that happened.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that's meaningful even still, right? Because you didn't invent the caprese salad. You didn't invent the idea of putting tomato and mozzarella and basil together.
No, and I didn't invent spaghetti aglio olio or, you know, all the other things that were on the menu. But I think it was maybe the first time that they were just put together in a way that made them super attractive to a large number of people.
Sure. Which is a very modest way of saying you popularize these dishes that are totally ubiquitous now. And not just the dishes, but elements of Italian culture, right? That at the time, you know, as Americans as a whole, many of us weren't tuned into yet. And I've heard you say that for you, the restaurant scene was an educational enterprise.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So... And you would give your waiters quizzes so that they would know.
Oh, yeah, they had to study. There was no bruschetta at Angeli. I mean, you know, I had been an Italian major. I couldn't have people working for me mispronouncing Italian words or have misspelled words on the menu or because at that time, most Italian restaurants that were getting press were Northern Italian restaurants, and it was rich food, and a lot of sauces, and it was like the opposite of what I was doing, and they needed to be able to explain that to people who would order a spaghetti aglio olio, and it would come, and it would be a bowl of spaghetti
with olive oil and garlic.
Yes, with olive oil and a few, you know, slices of golden garlic. And they just didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
People sometimes were just like, and the waiters had to kind of like jolly them along and bring them into the fold, so to speak.
Yeah, I love that idea. But I also love this idea that like you had the waiters having conversation and they were cultural conversations, right? And now it's such a cliche, like, oh, chef would like you to know that the arugula is from, you know, chef would like you to know that she invented this one day while waking up in a field of lavender, you know, whatever. But back then in the 80s, like how did people react to that? Did it feel like it was working?
Yeah, I think people were hungry to know, I think. Okay. And those who were, I mean, it was LA after all. So the people that were sort of too snobby to admit that they didn't know something or understand something just never came back. So it, so until
they
later.
They nodded their heads knowingly and then be like, oh, God.
Yeah, until somebody, until somebody else opened a cafe that had a, you know, a different level of fame or whatever. I don't know. But I mean, Wolfgang opening Spago really helped, I have to say. Mm-hmm.
Wolfgang Puck, yeah.
Yeah. And, but it, the restaurant, you know, it morphed because guests take ownership of your space.
Hmm.
And so it started out as this sort of cutting edge hipster cafe in 1984. And in 2012, when I closed it, it was like this hilarious place where at one table you would have people who lived in the neighborhood in their sweatpants, like in pandemic garb, let's say. Yeah. Eating there like maybe four times a week. It was basically their kitchen. And those people dressed like that could be, you know, actors, well-known actors or producers, people in the movie business, sitting next to a young couple all dressed up going out for their first date. Mm. And because by now I had had an entire generation of kids who grew up there. I was in, you know, as I was preparing to talk to you today, Francis, I was thinking about, I think that's what I miss the most about not having Anjali is when I meet children who are like 8 years old to 10 years old. And I think how sad that they never got to experience Anjali because it was such a loving environment for children. My waiters just loved them, and we let every kid make their own pizza, and yeah, it was a special place.
Yeah. And you did have two restaurants after that, but I actually want to move over to your side hustle.
Yeah, radio.
So sometime 97 or 98, I guess no one is really sure, you took over as the host of a radio show about food. Who would ever do such a thing? Good Food on KCRW, iconic show. You know, and it was a show that, you know, started right around the time Splendid Table was starting. And, you know, Sally and Lynn have told me stories about how when they started, you know, folks were like, so wait, what do you do? Like, you're going to talk about food? Like, what do you do? Just, like, go on the air and just talk about how to make a recipe? So, like, what was that experience for you? Did you or your producers, like, have to convince people it was worthwhile to talk about food?
Well, I wasn't the one who pitched the show. The show was pitched and originally hosted by Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, who had burst onto the burgeoning television food scene as the Two Hot Tamales.
Yeah, yeah.
They were, you know, my companions in arms as fellow female chefs in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. We had restaurants on the same street.
Yeah.
And so they had pitched this idea to KCRW. And then after they had done it for about a year, they stepped back. And I had been a guest on the show a few times. And so the producer, Jennifer Farrow, who is now president at KCRW.
Oh, cool.
Asked me if I would do it. And I said, sure. Sure, why not?
With that level of enthusiasm, sure.
Yeah, well, that level of confidence, let's say. Mm,
okay.
And she told me after I'd done my first show that the station manager at the time, Ruth Seymour, asked her how she had managed to find someone who could talk about food using four-syllable words.
Wait, was that a compliment or not?
I believe that it was a compliment.
Okay, okay.
But in those early years, Jennifer really had to beat back my extreme nerdiness because the audience wasn't ready. In a minute, my chat with splendid table host Frances Lam continues. That's next when Good Food returns. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this week I'm being interviewed by Frances Lam of Splendid Table.
Okay, so I'm actually watching the Julia Child, like, bio, you know, dramatized biographical series that's on TV right now. And
the one with Sarah Lancaster?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And obviously it's fictionalized, but, you know, in the first few episodes, you know, she's pitching her show to TV in the 60s, and, you know, the reaction in the, you know, in the producer's offices was probably accurate. Like, food wasn't something that was high-minded enough to have a show about, right? And yet here we are 35 years later, and you have Good Food on the radio, and what is the attitude towards it if you're saying, oh, the audience wasn't really quite ready in a certain way?
Well, I think the audience was ready to hear recipes on the radio. And there were the kind of food shows around on AM radio, right? On commercial radio that were, you know, where there were a million commercial spots an hour that were all underwritten by food companies, you know, large food companies or restaurants even. But those shows were... I don't know, maybe like BuzzFeed, like the BuzzFeed of food, you know, where it was just the very surface and very short. Although there were people, you know, on local radio doing restaurant reviews at that time. But I think really looking at food from a viewpoint that wasn't just in the plate, but was from, you know, bringing in farming voices and from a larger cultural perspective, I mean, that was missing completely.
Yeah. I actually love that because for as long as I can remember, you've had this segment on Good Food that is the market report, right? Where you have someone actually walking in the farmer's market, talking to farmers about, oh, what did you bring to the market this week? And, you know, what's a great way to use it? And, you know, that's something that, you know, feels so, I mean, is literally fresh.
And that grew out of the fact that in those days, so many chefs were just completely inarticulate. It was interesting. I mean, I would interview a chef and they just couldn't talk.
Okay.
Which I understand, having been a chef. And the reason I was a chef was because I couldn't talk. So I kind of totally understood. But we discovered that by... interviewing a chef in a market at the farmer's market along with a farmer, it became like more of a safe place for them in a way.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because you're really putting them in a place where they feel, this is what I'm comfortable doing. I want to I'll talk about this fennel.
Exactly. That I'm buying today to put on the menu tonight or tomorrow, and this is what I'm going to do with it.
Yeah. That's, you know what's really funny is when you said, back then, chefs couldn't talk, and Sally just texted me while we were having this conversation. And she said, ha ha, 100%.
I love that. I love having that validation. Yeah.
But okay, but then now it's been, you know, almost 25 years of you doing, I mean, probably literally thousands of interviews.
And yeah, when I tell people that I've done like probably around 6,000 interviews, they like roll their eyes, and I'm like, yeah, well, do the math. It's just, you know, every week.
Yeah. And, you know, you do, I mean, one reason why I've always loved listening to your show is because you have such a wide-ranging interest, and so you can totally geek out over, you know, this cool way to use fennel, and you'll talk to someone about, you know, a chef who is really careful to try to balance, you know, paying her workers, you know, real living wages while not gentrifying the, you know, the neighborhood she's in. You know, like the range can be so great on your show. And I think that's a product of how curious and how interested you are. But are there Are there favorite interviews you recall of those 6,000?
So many. So many. It's funny.
What are some of them?
I knew you would ask me. And I think number one, the most incredible thing, and I know that Lynn interviewed all these same people, but getting to interview nearly all of my culinary aunties, the women whose books, you know, formed my palate and taught me so much in my early teens and 20s. So like Claudia Rodden, Marcella Hazan, the first interview I did with Marcella was really personal and moving and amazing. And she and Victor ended up coming to Angeli a couple of times. And she ate my overcooked green beans with pancetta in the Italian style as one would make them. And she told me I was incredibly brave for making that way in a restaurant.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then, you know, Paula Wolford and, of course, Julia herself. I interviewed a couple times on her own, but especially with Jacques. I mean, those early interviews with Jacques Pepin when they started writing books together were just lovely. And then I discovered that he and I both had dogs, poodly dogs named Paco, and we ended up exchanging dog emails.
I want to believe that those are the emails your dogs actually have and that you would let the dogs talk to each other, but...
It was just awesome. We sent each other pictures of our dogs. But what I really loved was when Jennifer Farrow, my producer, got the idea to bring Jonathan Gold from the LA Times in every week for an on-air interview about his review that week. I mean, who knew that that would become this 20-year-long relationship of where I had a standing meeting with Jonathan Gold to talk to him about food. I mean, that will forever be a highlight of my personal and professional life.
Yeah, what a gift. I mean, Jonathan Gold is probably the greatest restaurant critic who's ever worked in America. I'll go ahead and say that.
And you know, when you get to talk to him in person about it, I mean, he really pushed me to look at food with a different vocabulary. And as a person who already could talk about food with four-syllable words, that was something pretty great.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never did this by myself. I always had producers. And depending upon who the producers were, who were all volunteers at that time, you know, some would be wacky, some would be serious, and they would bring this range of stuff to us. And so for some of the things I loved is I interviewed a father-son duo who won a cherry spitting contest in Michigan. I mean, we actually heard them spit cherry pits on the air.
That's incredible. Tell me more about them. How do they develop their skills? Like, I want to know everything now.
I mean, by just doing it over and over again. But the funniest thing was how the father and the son disagreed about the proper form, of course. So they got into it. And one of my favorite things I ever did was probably eating a selection of dirt sent to me by an anthropologist for a segment I did on pica.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
No. It was just amazing. It was amazing.
I feel like I'm so lame. Like, why would it have never occurred to me to go to a segment on dirt eating? Geophagy, right? Is the
yeah. I mean, we talked about
that's four syllables. Geophagy, that's four syllables.
We talked about pica in all its form, including cornstarch and rabbit ice, which is that ice that people now, I understand, buy the machines to make it for them at home, that it has that structure that when you bite into it, it has a very particular kind of crunch. It's kind of soft and crisp all at the same time.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was really fascinating. But then we also talked to a vegetable psychic who talked to carrots.
I've never heard a more LA thing in my entire life. This is why you can make your show in LA and like our show is in St. Paul, Minnesota, no vegetable psychics.
And I remember, I just remember a very, very, very early vegan episode where a woman was extolling a chocolate cake made with cabbage and black beans. And, oh my goodness, it was just a misguided recipe.
I wanted you to say it was, oh, so surprisingly delicious, but no.
But then, you know, the last Seltzer Man was like an incredible episode I remember doing. The history of the toothpick. I always love these weird, like you would never imagine the whole cultural story behind something like a toothpick or.
Yeah.
Or even seltzer. And then I think, you know, as the years rolled by and this show had a bit more money, the opportunity to have people produce segments that became features on the show in which my voice was never heard. I mean, one of our producers, Gideon Brower, did two episodes that were just incredible. He went to the Fancy Chicken Show. And he just did a hilarious episode on show chickens. And then
show chicken.
Yeah, show chickens. And then later on, he did a piece on the creation of edible candy pants.
What?
In the 70s. And that is just such an iconic segment for us.
What, literally edible pants?
Edible panties.
Okay.
Oh my God, Francis, you're so young.
I'll need to dive into the archives. And with 24 or 25 years of them with you at the helm, there is plenty to discover and explore.
I just want to say, one of the great pleasures of having been at KCRW for so long are also how we're able to convert our virtual listeners into actual community through events. And for example, Pi, you know, I started mm-hmm. being obsessed with Pi several years ago, and we ended up creating this Pi contest going on 12 years where thousands of people come to taste more than 500 entries judged by the greatest pastry chefs in LA.
Wow.
And then during the pandemic, we needed to do something about the way we were interviewing all of these restaurant owners and chefs who were going through such hell.
Yeah.
And we came up with this segment called In the Weeds, in which I interview the people, but then we edit out my voice completely. So it becomes a first person telling of their food mm-hmm, story. Mm-hmm. And they've become quite powerful.
Yeah, I love them.
And of course, you know, we also, it's LA, after all, we do a tortilla contest every year that is hilarious and fabulous.
I got to come out for that.
Oh my God, it's so awesome. 64, it's a bracket. It's run by journalist Gustavo Arellano, and we start out with 64 tortillas and end up with one.
One tortilla to rule them all.
Yep.
Evan, this has been such a blast. I want to thank you for coming on the show, but I also want to thank you for, you know, being such a guiding light for so many of us for so long. You know, obviously I stand in the footsteps of Lynn and Sally for having created the Splendid Table, but, you know, I don't know that I could do what I do without you having been there doing this in California. So thank you so much.
Oh, that is like so sweet, Francis. Thank you. I so appreciate it. That was Francis Lamb of The Splendid Table interviewing yours truly. For a transcript of this conversation, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims with the Market Report. I'm here on a beautiful, sunny Wednesday day at the Santa Monica Farmer's Market, speaking with Francesco Lucatorto, chef owner of Cecchi's Gastronomia in Silver Lake. What are you looking for at the market this morning?
This morning I'm looking and scouting for Swiss chard, green chard actually, which is a green seasonal right now that it's about to end, I believe. And it's a delicious little sweet and very mineral collard green. I use it in one of our recipes at a restaurant. It's called erbazzone or torta d'erbe, which is a mix of dandelions and green chard. A little bit of parmigiano encased in a beautiful little thin savory crust.
Amazing. Tell us a little bit about the history of the dish that you're talking about.
It comes from the dearest memory possibly of my childhood. Like the smell of this dish coming out of my grandma's kitchen was like what it really excited me as soon as I walked in. So it's the history is just a family recipe that's been developed in the area of the Parma and Reggio Emilia provinces. So in between the plains and the sea in the little mountains above, you know, Liguria and behind Emilia Romagna.
So tell me about the variety of Swiss chard and what flavor does it bring and like how does it balance the dandelion greens and how does it work in the mix?
I think it's just a perfect balance between sweetness of the green chard and the minerality that they have. Even when you eat it raw, you have a beautiful sweet taste, but then the minerality comes back and makes your mouth salivating. And that counterbalances the highly bitterness of the dandelion greens, which is, you know, as you all know, a chicory. So it's like really, really bitter. And that really balances out the dish with the salinity of the Parmigiano Reggiano, sweetness of the Swiss chard, and the bitterness of the dandelion greens.
You have some Swiss chard left over. How do you like to cook it outside of this dish that you're making?
I love to cook the stems inside because we don't use all the white part. A great way to use it is to make a filling for some ravioli, even just a quick cold pickle of them and jar them up. It's a great substitute for like a snack, a little aperitivo time. I love my green chard as a filling, for example, for some ravioli, just even the leaf cream, some ricotta, eggs, parmigiano, a little nutmeg, a little salt, a little olive oil, and that goes into a filling. We do make a torta pasqualina, which is a dish that I just made for Easter at the Gastronomia a couple of months back. And it is a ricotta and Swiss chard and spinach sometimes. There is also an artichoke variation of it. It's basically a thicker savory pie with some eggs that are being placed raw inside the filling and then covered up with another layer of dough and then baked. And that's, you know, as you can imagine, a very Eastery dish with like boiled eggs inside. So that's one another recipe. Or just quickly saute with a little bit of garlic and oil if you want to make it spicy, some chili flakes, some Calabrian chili flakes, and that's it.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Francesco.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ben, for having me.
That was Francesco Lucatorto, chef owner of Cecchi's Gastronomia in Silver Lake. I'm here with Julia Tamai of Tamai Family Farms in Ventura. How are you doing, Julia?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we just spoke with Francesco Lucatorto, who's an Italian chef in Silver Lake. He has a restaurant called Cecchi's Gastronomia, and he makes kind of an Italian pie with your Swiss chard. Tell me about the Swiss chard that you guys grow, how long you've been growing it, and kind of everything about that green.
Well, first, we've been growing tons of vegetables for the past 50 years. It's a family-run farm. Swiss chard, it happened by chance by the restaurants asking, hey, can you grow this for us? So we started off with just the green and red, and then we added the rainbow, which you get red, green, and gold in it. So it's a nice variety, but it's very creamy texture. You could use it like spinach, and then the bottoms you can almost use in stir fry for bok choy. So it's a very versatile vegetable.
Is there a difference in the color of stems?
Oh, no, just different varieties. They grow the same. We grow about a quarter of an acre. So how Swiss chard grows is you plant it from baby, and then it just kind of grows almost like a tree. It almost looks like the leaves of a beet, and you just keep picking, and it constantly keeps regrowing. So it's one of those nice vegetables to have that you don't need to take up a lot of space, and you get plenty of it. So recommend growing it at home, too. It's pretty bug tolerant because we don't use any pesticides or sprays on it.
How does it compare to other greens, you know, like kale or spinach and all those other kind of things that you guys grow as well?
Ooh, good question. Kale, you can actually taste the green in it, shall I say. With the green chard, just because they're different colors, they all have different textures. So the green is a little creamier. And that one has a little more natural saltiness, where the red is a little wholesome. It tastes more like a red beet green. That one's really nice in salads, and it's a little more tender.
Okay, so the colors kind of have a different flavor, slightly different.
Slightly different flavor and different nutritional value. Usually with the darker the color, the more nutritional value. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but that's the rule of thumb.
If you're cooking it for yourself at home, how do you like to eat Swiss chard?
Ooh, good question. I've done it stir fry when I can't find bok choy. It's a nice substitute. And then I've also used it in my pasta. It's really good. So you just kind of stem the greens off the big white stem on the green one, and then you just toss it in your pasta and it cooks down, but it gives a lot of texture to it.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Julia.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
That was Julia Tamai of Tamai Family Farms in Ventura. For the Market Report, this is Ben Mims.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or any podcast app out there. My thanks to the splendid table crew, Francis Lamb, Erica Romero, Sally Swift, and Jennifer Libke. My thanks also to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. Find me on Instagram at KCRWEvan or on Twitter at Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.